Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects that we all struggle with in this conversation with a reluctant therapist.
And yes, happy Tuesday. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, coming to you again this week from Lincoln, Nebraska, and part two of my conversation with author, activist, and psychotherapist, Dr. Mary Pfeiffer. Lincoln is actually the halfway point of my summer adventure driving across the country. We started out in Denver, Colorado, and worked our way up into the Black Hills of South Dakota, having great conversations, seeing amazing places, and then we worked our way across Nebraska here to Lincoln to have this conversation with Dr. Pfeiffer. Mary Pfeiffer was actually the goal of this drive across the country because I'd always wanted to meet this woman who was an inspiration and guide for my professional and my private life since I read her first book, Reviving Ophelia, back in 1994. So I'd always wanted to have this conversation in person, and I thought, what a better way to get to know someone than to see them in their home, on their home turf, where she gets her inspiration, where she finds her values, and where she finds her soul. So we made this drive across the country, and we're here in Dr. Pfeiffer's beautiful home, and having a conversation about mental health and well-being. Since 1994, Dr. Pfeiffer has written 8 other books that have positively impacted my life, most notably The Shelter of Each Other, which explores and describes the challenges facing families today in our modern, complex, and chaotic society, and how we can find the courage as individuals, as professionals, to protect and nurture our most cherished relationships. Another one of her books, Writing to Change the World, I found incredibly inspiring, encouraging all of us to find that activist voice inside of us and to write about those things that we have passion for. In her most recent book, The Green Boat, explores activism as a remedy for the feelings of disconnect, trauma, and overwhelm that many of us experience in the face of our current climate crisis and global chaos. And it also describes her work as an activist fighting the tar sands pipeline. Dr. Pfeiffer blends her years of professional training as both a psychologist and anthropologist with a deep rootedness in the values, lifestyle, and natural beauty of her home state of Nebraska. So we're doing things a little differently today. We won't be taking calls, but you can still be a part of our conversation by liking our Facebook page. There you can leave comments or questions or ideas. You can also find out about our upcoming shows or see photos of my guests or some of the places that we've visited so far. You can also follow us on our new Instagram, The Reluctant Therapist. And you can listen to previous shows, part one of my conversation with Mary Pfeiffer and all of the others, at kcbx.org. Just look under the News Talk tab. And if you'd like to keep up through your device, you can podcast our shows through iTunes. Make sure you find A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. Subscribe, and the shows will be downloaded, and you can listen at your convenience. So today, my conversation with Dr. Mary Pfeiffer looks at her recently revised book, Letters to a Young Therapist. This conversation explores the role of therapy and the therapist in helping us all to better navigate, cope with, and deal with the challenges and complexities of our modern life. And it's not just for young therapists, but it's also looking at mental health and well-being for all of us who struggle with different normal developmental challenges and psychic traumas and how to best aid our lives and those that we care most about. So this is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you're listening to Public Radio KCBX. I'm happy to reintroduce you to my hero, Dr. Mary Pfeiffer, from her home here in Lincoln, Nebraska.
Sometimes we know, sometimes we don't. Sometimes we give, sometimes we won't. Sometimes we're strong, sometimes we're wrong. Sometimes we cry. Sometimes it's bad when the going gets tough. Yeah, we look in the mirror and we want to give up. Sometimes we don't even think we'll try.
So let's get started because when I just finished reading Letters to a Young Therapist, which was recently updated, one mm-hmm. of your books, mm-hmm. and in this book, you speak with such hopefulness, with such encouragement for the next generation of therapists and the work that mm-hmm. you're doing. Mm-hmm. And I'm so reluctant because right. of the show. I'm so concerned about the work that's being done and the work of young therapists or the future of psychotherapy as a whole. And so I'm wondering, why are you so hopeful?
Well, first of all, I've been hopeful all my life. I think attitude isn't everything, but it's almost everything. And I grew up in a quite difficult set of circumstances. And what was most important for me was a hopeful attitude. So it's partly who I am. But also, from my point of view, the best description of a therapist is purveyor of hope. That's a Donald Meichenbaum phrase, purveyor of hope. But I truly believe people come to us because their backs are up against the wall and they need some direction, of course, and someone to listen to them. But primarily, they need to believe that they have some agency in making their own lives better. So from my point of view, if you aren't a hopeful person, if you aren't able to inspire hope in other people, it's probably not the profession for you. And the same with, I believe that about writing and speaking and teaching, that if your message to the reader is life is hell, spare the reader. There's no point telling people that their futures are dark, they have no control, they should be gloomy and feel badly about everything. We all more or less know that already. So it's important to point people toward the light.
So let's backtrack a little bit then to what inspired you to go into the work of therapy, the world of therapy, at the time that you went into it, and how your background or your childhood influenced who you became as a therapist.
Well, first of all, I was just born curious. And as you know, having read Letters to a Young Therapist, I don't think there's anything more interested in than people. I've always been interested in people. I came from a very diverse, big, complicated family. I had some communists in my family. I had some John Birchers in my family. I had hillbillies in my family. I had very sophisticated people living in L.A. in my family. And one of my favorite things as a child was to try to make sense of all these people and to understand point of view and how different points of view connected with each other. The other thing I was really interested from the time I was really small was disaster stories. My mother loved to tell me stories about the Donner Party or the Titanic or Marie Antoinette. Well, from my point of view, those stories were interesting and still are interesting because they talk about what happens when fate meets personality. And that's what therapy is. Therapy is people coming in saying, I've hit the limits of my endurance and I don't know what to do next. And so it's the most interesting moment in a person's life. It's a great gift to have people trust me enough, trust any therapist enough, to really sit down and tell the truth about their inner experience. And I never got tired of being a therapist. I retired at a certain point because I was so busy traveling and writing and so on that I couldn't be a good therapist anymore. But I loved being a therapist. The other thing is, I actually didn't plan to be a therapist. I planned to be a cultural anthropologist and study what I was really interested in the 1969 when I graduated from college was what happened when indigenous peoples all over the world ended up crashing into Western European industrial society. But I wanted to be where the action was. Now, it wasn't till I wasn't able to get a financed graduate program in cultural anthropology. I could go to Berkeley or anywhere I wanted, but I couldn't get money. And so I decided to go to graduate school in psychology because at that time, NIMH was fully funding PhDs in clinical psychology.
And that's the National Institute for Mental Health?
Right. And they needed more psychologists in this culture. So it was a wonderful golden time to learn to be a therapist. We got all of our tuition paid for. We got a stipend all the way we were in grad school. So I was able to get my PhD and get out debt-free. And I really actually feel almost sad saying that now because I know how different education is. I know how many of your listeners are struggling with their graduate debts and thinking, how can I pay these debts? So it was a very lucky time for me. It's a much less lucky time now for people. But I loved being a therapist, and I'm really grateful that I stumbled into that kind of work. You know, Elizabeth, it's only in retrospect that your life looks linear. When you're young and trying to find yourself and dating and deciding who you want to marry and whether you want to have kids and where you want to live and what kind of work you want to do, there's a lot of randomness and chance and good luck or bad luck and mistakes and directions. You think this will be my life, but it turns out not to be your life. And I just feel extraordinarily lucky that I stumbled on a number of moments that allowed me have a life that in retrospect, it was the perfect life for me, just the perfect life for me.
So going back to my original question a little bit, because as I've talked about on my show over the course of 8 years, I'm the reluctant therapist because I'm concerned about the direction of the way we're doing psychotherapy today, the overuse of medications, the pathologizing of the normal events of human life, like grief.
Right.
And so in your writings, and you talked about, you know, the hopefulness that's inherent in being a good therapist, but do you feel hopeful about the direction of psychotherapy as it is being practiced?
Well, first of all, what I'm really hopeful about is the human race. I'm not particularly hopeful about any profession in America as it's being practiced, whether it's psychotherapy or medicine or law or education, because everything is money driven. And when questions are about money versus about quality of life and human welfare and kindness, the questions are the wrong questions. And ultimately the answers aren't quite right either. But I'll tell you what I see as the positive things now and the negative things. On the positive side, we know a lot more. We have much better protocols for everything from obsessive compulsive disorder to how to do marriage work. I did a lot of marital therapy when I was a therapist, and I have to say I never really knew what I was doing. I was a good listener. I was kind. Every now and then I think I made a practical suggestion. But I had virtually no training in marital therapy, and nobody else did either.
Or sex therapy.
I actually had training
in
sex therapy, but I didn't have training in marital relationship therapy. So one and the other, they need to actually be linked a little bit more than they were in my training. We have better protocols for I don't like the term borderline personality. In fact, I don't like labeling. And all of my career, I've never been a labeler because a label looks like it's explaining something when it explains nothing. And it takes very complicated and interesting people and reduces them to something that a therapist and other people think they understand too prematurely. So I don't like labeling at all. And plus, there's, of course, a lot of other implications like stigma and so on.
I know, because we talk about, you know, wanting to reduce the stigma of mental health issues. That's such a mantra in the world right now, reducing the stigma. But from my perspective, the DSM-5 is all about stigmatizing, because it's pigeonholing in some ways, and labeling and telling people who they are in a very small way. I mean,
well, the DSM-5, in my opinion, was corrupted in the process of making it. And among other things, it was corrupted by drug companies who wanted categories to somehow correspond with drugs on the market. But it was also corrupted just by the nature of the panel and the fact that, Elizabeth, there weren't too many people like you and me on it, you know. But positive, let me stay with that a minute. So positive are, we have better protocols. We understand the brain more. I think the neuro has been oversold to therapists. I think it isn't as useful as we were told it would be. But on the other hand, it's somewhat useful, and I'm glad I have it. I also think more and more therapists are using mindfulness and the Buddhist work. I think that's extraordinarily useful to people. And, for example, if I were doing therapy now, I would start and end every session with a minute meditation, just to give people a moment to calm down and center and be present before they enter the talking time.
I actually start each of my classes with a minute of meditation in and out.
See,
to get my students focused.
That's excellent. That's just excellent work. And I would do it too in class. And then the other thing I think is therapists are more aware of the body. And, for example, another change I would make in my therapy for a lot of clients is I would say, come see me every other week, and on the off week, go get a good massage. Mm-hmm. Massage is so healing at such a deep level and such a stress reducer that I think our clients would be well served possibly by less talking and more massage. The negatives are medicine. I'm really disturbed. I don't actually watch television, but I've heard this from a lot of people, that psychotropic drugs are actually advertised on television. Because they should only be used as a last resort. And all the years I practiced therapy, I think probably I referred 10 people for medicine over the years. I really think there's much better ways to help people overcome whatever struggles they're having. On the other hand, I think medicine could be useful. And when I thought it could be useful, I recommended people use it. I also think that what's best and most important about the therapeutic relationship is extremely simple. Two people sit down in a room together. One person says, for the next 50 minutes, I will pay total attention to you. I will listen. I will try to be in attunement with you. I will try to deeply understand your point of view, and I will be thinking and feeling, how can I most help you? That's what works. And I actually really liked walking out to the waiting room to meet my new client with no information about them at all. Now, of course, people check each other out on Facebook, and there's also a lot of actually doing therapy. On Skype or via email and via chat rooms and so on. And I don't know enough about those areas to be any kind of knowledgeable critic and speak with authority. But based on what I do know, I think all of those kinds of work very much dilute the power of that 50-minute hour. That's one of the things Freud was very right about, is 50 minutes of concentrated attention to another human being can be a really magical experience for anyone. So the medicine, the DSM-5, and the insurance is terrible. If I were practicing now, I wouldn't work with insurance, because one of the things that insurance companies want is a lot of focus on pathology to justify the money. So if you're helping your client get money so they can be reimbursed, you have to have in your conversations with the therapy company a great number of alarming statements. And we all know that information is globally shared at this point. And there's a very good chance that when we give anyone information about a client, ultimately we are doing them harm. So I'm very unhappy with insurance. when I was doing therapy, which was from essentially about 1976 to 2000, I had a practice. I still do therapy a lot, but it's informally. But when I was in private practice doing therapy, we just virtually needed no insurance. We had a standard form we filled out. I think 95% of my clients got adjustment reaction of adult life. And there was...
That would be the diagnosis that we had to use. Just a very broad,
right,
non-specific...
And we didn't have to give insurance companies any specific information,
right,
about our clients. So people's confidentiality actually was protected at that time. So there's a bigger topic about therapy, and we'll get to it with another question.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and my guest today is Dr. Mary Pfeiffer, author, activist, and psychotherapist, and we're coming to you from her home in Lincoln, Nebraska. So we're not taking calls today, but you can still connect with us through our Facebook page, on Instagram at The Reluctant Therapist, or through sending an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Our previous shows are available at kcbx.org, along with our part one of our conversation with Dr. Pfeiffer. And you can also grab our conversations by looking at podcasts under iTunes or your app on your phone. And we continue this conversation talking about suffering, pathology, and trauma as inherent parts of our human story. This is Dr. Mary Pfeiffer. You know, I hear a little of the reluctance in you.
Of course.
So I'm at least it's not just all blind hope. And one of the things you talked about was the work of neuroscience and the influence on the work we're doing today. And what I've found interesting is that a lot of the neuroscience has really just proven what we knew worked all along as talk therapists. We just didn't have the science to back it up. I mean, I've always felt it kind of just solidified what we believed about our practice.
Right. Well, and Dan Siegel's a friend of mine. Oh. And I've blurbed his books, and I have heard him speak. And I think, for example, Dan is one of the leaders of neuropsychology, has really over the years said many important and interesting things that we can benefit from. On the other hand, I don't think if I were doing therapy now, my therapy would be substantially different, mm-hmm, based on the fact that I've really looked into neuro. In fact, it was such hard work for me to look into neuro and learn all of that, that I'm not sure but what I could have spent the time better in terms of genuinely helping people. So I hope that doesn't upset too many of your listeners who are very big in neuro. And one good thing about that particular area is that there are little employment niches in it. So it can be useful to people who are struggling to get jobs, that they have that background. And in that sense, I think it's very valuable to people.
Well, and I think that's, you know, one of the struggles for our profession has been, I felt, after, you know, the golden age of therapy, you know, the family therapists, family systems years, the 60s, 70s, in the 80s when managed care came in, it kind of started shifting things. And it seemed like our profession was really desperately trying to have, to be seen as more solid as a scientific practice instead of what I thought was more of a humanistic practice, you know, that there was that switch from just trusting the human experience of two people talking to each other and then trying to align ourselves with medicine as being a hard science.
Right. Well, for example, the Gottmans and Harville Hendricks.
Love them.
And Sue Johnson, they all have very scientific research-based models, but they're humanistic too. Mm-hmm. I've always thought more in humanistic terms about therapy. And one of the ways I think it can still be extraordinarily useful is in our extremely loud culture. There's very few places where the individual human voice is attended and respected. And if all a therapist does is convey to a person by 50 minutes of time, you are important to me and your concerns matter to me and your point of view is legitimate. And as I come to understand you, I empathize with you. That is a legitimate spending of 50 minutes with someone. So I think there's still a tremendous amount to be gained. And what I tend to do now, since I don't have a private practice, is I do a lot I do a lot of two things. I do a lot of coaching with young people mm-hmm. who just want to take a walk around this lake with me or go out for coffee and ask me about things. And coaching of young people in the community who are trying to start some kind of program they're enthusiastic about, but they've never written a grant and they don't know who to talk to. And then I do a lot of work with refugees still. I've stayed very connected to the refugee community, and refugees call me a lot and they have some problem they need to talk through. And what I really find is most helpful to people is just the experience of being held and heard and empathized with and understood. And sometimes, like one time I was helping this woman write a book. It's a very interesting story. It's too long to tell the whole story. But the title of her book was I Will Die Walking. And it was from a woman who left a refugee camp in Africa carrying her children and lost a daughter along the way. Well, she ended up thinking she was writing a book, but she got into some kind of a deal with someone who later told her that she would change the name of the book and say she wrote it, and then refer to my refugee friend as in the acknowledgments, as thank you for sharing your story. Well, my refugee friend got very upset about that. She didn't really understand publishing. She didn't know if this woman was right or not. So I did the research to figure out what had actually happened, and I actually corresponded some with the writer. But eventually, I talked to my refugee friend for about an hour and a half, and she poured out this whole painful story to her. It was when someone stole that story of hers, they stole her life. They stole what she had to say to the world. And she poured out the whole story of the misunderstanding and how scared she was and how her daughter wanted to sue and so on and so on. And at the end, I said, well, how can I help you? How can I help you? And she said, you did just help me. That's all I wanted, you to believe me, you to hear what I had to say and believe me. And that's incredibly important. People want to be understood and they want to be believed. Now, believing people doesn't mean you totally buy every story. And therapists have gotten in a lot of trouble with that. But what it means is while you're listening to them, you work very hard to find within their story that which is honorable and believable and helpful to them in terms of later reframing of the story in a way that lets them become more authentic and more joyous. You know, if people come into therapy, they almost always have what Michael White called a problem-saturated story. So you're obviously going to hear a story saturated with problems and pain and failure. So obviously you don't want to totally believe that story or you can't be of help. So you want to listen to that story and give the person the sense, I totally understand where you are at this moment. I accept it. I respect you where you are. I honor you. And let's talk a little about your story.
In your book, Letters to a Young Therapist, you wrote this to Laura, mm-hmm. Who I guess she wasn't a fictional.
No, she was an actual student of mine.
She was an actual graduate student of yours. And I wanted to spend some time kind of going through some of the things that you talked about in the book. We talked about, you know, our human needs and desires. This is what you wrote in the book. Our human needs and desires have not changed over the 2,000 years of the years of humanity. We all want to be understood, respected, and loved, to feel useful, to be happy. And the fact is that we all suffer. And so I'd like to talk about the role of suffering, because trauma and trauma work is so big right now in the field. There's a lot of people that say that almost every mental health concern we have is somehow steeped in trauma. So can you talk about your term, the transcendent response to trauma, and how that influences therapy or healing?
Well, we could talk about that for about 5 hours, couldn't we?
Absolutely.
First of all, that trauma is a word I've used a lot, and it's not necessarily a bad word. Another word that is often confused with the word trauma is sadness or despair. I just read Sebastian Junger's book, Tribe. Have you read that book?
I have not.
It's a very interesting book, but one of the points he makes in that book is very simpatico with my points, which is we humans have been around, oh, let's say 200,000 years. We have mammalian arousal systems. We have Neolithic brains. These brains were built to live communally in small groups, to spend all of our time with each other, to live outdoors on solar time and moon time and seasonal time, and to be together around a fire telling stories at night. If you think about what the human being was constructed to be, our current age could not be further from that. We're isolated, we're overwhelmed with information, we're constantly moving around the world alone, dealing with strangers. A lot of times our work is only meaningful in the most abstract of senses, etc. But one of his premises is that what we're calling PTSD with a great many vets is actually not PTSD at all. It's a yearning for the time they were at war. Mm-hmm. And the reason for that is when they were at war, they were never more than about a foot away from another person. They had a strong sense of mission. Everybody was more or less treated equal. They had opportunities to be heroes. They had opportunities every day to contribute to the common good. They shared all their joys and sorrows together. And that when people who've gone through those kind of experiences come back and go into the little isolated, atomized worlds we all live in, they never recover. They have a kind of a soul death. And it's a very interesting premise. I can't speak to it with much authority, but it fits something I believe very strongly, which is the further we get away from being the mammals and early Homo sapiens, the more miserable we are.
So by mere virtue of being humans in this time period, we're all on some level traumatized?
I think we're very traumatized. I think that, first of all, I know that. If you look at anything from domestic violence to addiction rates to suicide rates to road rage, all of that is just a sign of people on overwhelm. We're all on overwhelm all the time. And in fact, one thing that you see all over this culture is Tai Chi, meditation, isolation tanks, mindfulness, retreats, anything people can do to cut down stimulation, they seek doing it. Now, this may not be true with 20-year-olds in New York City, but for many people, it's an incredibly good experience to just be anywhere and calm down. My favorite experience, I proselytize about this, is when you're troubled, when you're anxious, when you're having trouble with a monkey mind, go lie down under the stars. And it's impossible, or for that matter, under the daylight sky. It's impossible to lie down and look at the sky more than 5 or 10 minutes without things coming back in perspective. And when you think about that, how old is that human experience of lying down and looking at the sky, you know? I just had an amazing experience. I was on a trip with my friend Jan, And we were at a place where the stars were very low and liquid, and the ocean was nearby, and there were coconut palms. And so I went out one night and lay on a mat under these stars. And I had an epiphany. First of all, what I noticed is I was looking at those stars like I needed an answer, like I had a question. I was peering at them like, tell me the answer. And of course, I didn't even know the question. But I realized my mindset was, I need something from you. I need an answer. And then I started thinking of my relatives, my gone relatives, my grandmothers, my grandfather, my aunts and uncles, my parents, my many friends who are gone by now. And I some people, when I thought of them, my face would get very, I would feel a sort of a mask of pain cross my face. And other people, I didn't feel that. And then I started wishing I'd see a falling star, that that would be a sign from someone. But then I thought, this is so me, but it's so 2016 westernized human being. I wanted something from those stars. I wanted to manipulate them. I wanted something in my mind to make something happen in the sky. And then my next thought, it was like a cool wave breaking over me. My next thought was, just let the stars be stars. Stars are enough. They're enough just exactly the way they are. And I don't have to worry about them. I don't have to try to make them do anything. And for that matter, I thought about the word honesty at the same time. And I realized that for me, what honesty means is simply labeling accurately what is going on. Telling the truth means when I'm angry, I say I'm angry. When I'm hungry, I say I'm hungry. When I'm lying under the stars feeling peaceful, I say I'm feeling peaceful. It was just this great relief that nothing needs worked. And I think part of the way we live now, we're always about to go do something. We're always trying to make something happen.
And it is, or improve upon it.
Or improve upon it. And it's such a relief to look at something so much bigger and older and more ancient than us. Sometimes we cry.
Well, we're gonna have to sit down and figure it right through. If we're only human, what more can we do? The only thing to do is eat humble pie. Sometimes we cry. Or they put me in a jacket, and they're taking me away. I'm not gonna fake it like Johnny Ray.
This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett, and you're listening to my recent conversation with Dr. Mary Pfeiffer, author of Reviving Ophelia and 8 other books, including The Green Boat and her recently revised Letters to a Young Therapist. We aren't taking calls today because I'm coming to you from Lincoln, Nebraska. This is all part of my Shows from the Road summer driving across the country. But this is an opportunity for you to get to know someone that I've always admired and looked up to, and I am excited to share this part 2 of our visit. You can listen to part 1 and other shows at kcbx.org. And we now continue with our discussion about coping with loss and suffering with Dr. Mary Pfeiffer.
And so to go back a little bit, because we started talking about the role of trauma and suffering in the human experience, and that going along with what you're saying, that we feel like we should be able to manipulate everything or improve something or do something, but we don't talk about the fact that a great deal of human life is suffering, that there's loss.
Absolutely.
And there's sadness and there's anger and PTSD or returning from a place where you felt a great sense of camaraderie and now feeling alone. Can you talk about the role of suffering and its importance in the human experience?
Well, you know, David White has a beautiful line, which is, before we go, we will say goodbye to everyone we love, one way or the other. Life is filled with sorrow. Buddha knew this in his story of the mustard seed. When I proceed around the world interacting with cashiers or children in a park or an older woman like myself at a rec center, I proceed on the assumption that person is having a hard time. Now, we all have happy times. We all have carefree moments. Some of us are very lucky and have, in general, very good lives. But everybody has a hard time. And many people are having a much harder time than we realize. In fact, in America especially, we tend to be the culture of perkiness. So if you ask people how they are, they're fine. And in a sense, that makes you even more isolated. Because if you don't feel fine inside, you think, what's wrong with me that I don't feel fine? And inside, none of us feel fine all the time. We have a rainbow of tumultuous and stormy emotions to contend with. And that's if we're lucky. The people who don't have that have basically succeeded one way or another in killing their emotional range.
Which is, in some ways, isn't that the goal of modern day therapy and medication, is to dampen that range of emotions to one kind of flat experience? I mean, isn't that kind of what we're actually questing for as a people, is to cut back the normal range of emotions?
Well, I think psychotropic drugs like alcohol and pornography and internet addiction and shopping and binge eating, all of those things are a way to cut back on pain and suffering. And I don't want to legitimize them in the sense they're all self-destructive. That's what they have in common, or at least most of them are pretty self-destructive. But I do understand it, because people are in a great deal of pain and there's very little cultural education about how to actually deal with that pain. That's why a show like yours is so good, because it really says to people, here are some ideas for how you can actually feel calmer and more connected to other people and more authentic. That's what I've tried to write, is genuinely useful information that could be of help. But there's a great deal of misinformation out there in the culture. I think individual therapists are distinct from the profession.
Okay.
And I personally feel like virtually nobody goes into therapy for the money. It's not a well-paying profession. There's a great many serious hazards with therapy, including death threats. I mean, I was a therapist in a peaceful white-collar town with very low crime. I had 3 times in my career that my life was threatened. And that's probably pretty common for most therapists to have that happen to them two or three times in a lifetime. But there's also all kinds of hassles with insurance. There's very difficult people that come into therapy that require an enormous amount of energy. And there's the general hazard of the job, which is, at least for me, I would wear myself out at work with nurturing and paying attention, and then come home to a second life where people wanted nurtured and attention. And either I would dig deep and just be a burned out person by the time I hit the bed, or I wouldn't dig deep and be a guilty person by the time I hit the bed. So there's not a lot of great extrinsic motivators to being a therapist. The intrinsic motivator, I think, for almost all people is a genuine desire to help another human being. It's a really good motivate. I mean, it's a very good motive for picking any kind of work.
But aren't we getting, you know, the reluctant in me keeps coming up because I keep hearing this counter. But I understand that intrinsic drive, you know, working with grad students at school who are training to be therapists. I understand the intrinsic drive, but I see 2 problems. One, the profession seems to draw people who haven't done their own work, and, you know, so they continue thinking, well, I'll help other people, although they have not finished their own.
That's always been a problem with therapists.
So it's not new.
It's been a problem in the 70s. It was a big problem.
And then the other piece of it is, you may have the intrinsic drive to help others, and yet the container of how we're allowed to do the work, you know, if you're in an agency or with managed care or with the protocols or, you know, with medical evaluations towards, you know, medications. I mean, I just feel like the limitations on actually doing the soul work with another being limit good therapy today.
Well, and I think you're more an expert on that than me. So I don't want to comment on that. I do think that from my point of view, I've never had those limitations. Mm-hmm. You know, even now, I do a lot of free therapy. So I see people
I
that need help and take a walk with them or sit and have a cup of tea with them. And when I was a therapist, the fees were reasonable. One of the great things about the age of therapy we practiced was a lot of my clients were not wealthy. I mean, the Goodyear plant here in town had very good medical insurance. It included therapy. So by the time I quit being a therapist, most of the people that could afford to see me were middle income and above. I actually didn't like that particularly. I like seeing the whole range of people. But now I have a feeling that there's a kind of bifurcation for therapists. And they can go into a private practice where they practice pretty much the way I practiced and ask for cash and see people the way that therapists have always wanted to see people under ideal conditions. Or they take a job that requires them, they perhaps work with poor people, but they have to work under the constraints of very user-unfriendly systems. Now, I actually probably wouldn't choose to do that kind of work, but I sympathize with people who do because I think their motivations were good. They get caught up in something they can't control. And one of the reasons I like Letters to a Young Therapist being reissued is I like to think that book stays pretty close to the core mission of what a therapist is. And I hope it's a kind of a North Star for therapists and students. When they think about what is my work, really, it's to help people be happy. It's to help people be kind. It's to help people have self-knowledge. And, for example, diagnosis is really counter to self-knowledge. Once people have a diagnosis, this was true 30 years ago, just as it is now, they tend to think they have an explanation, when in fact they have no explanation at all. I'm not sure people need as much explanation as I thought, but they do need insight, and they do need a set of coping skills and mindfulness skills, and they need a sense for, the older I get, the more I think most of this revolves around story. They need a set of stories that allow them to function in a positive, hopeful, trusting way.
You're tuned to Public Radio KCBX. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is a conversation from the road with author, activist, psychologist Dr. Mary Pfeiffer from her home in Lincoln, Nebraska. We'll be wrapping up part two of our interview talking about the impact of our cultural story on our mental health and how we need to create a new story around resilience for us all to survive in the complex, challenging times that we're in. You know, it's funny because I've always resonated with Michael White's narrative therapy. Mm-hmm. And because my training is in depth psychology, which is all around mythology and how the story plays in our lives. And I see that also, you know, in the work today, that it's the cultural story that we're all trying to live out, right? That very narrow definition of the American dream, that it's all about right. success and money and materialistic gain. I mean, it's the story that we're all trying to fulfill that's actually at the root of our mental health disorders.
Right.
And so
exactly.
How do we, as therapists, as cultural leaders, I don't know if we're cultural leaders, but as therapists, help to redefine the story that our clients are living. And also, before we go too far away from that, you talked about, you know, being able to work with clients. You know, when you go into private practice, you get a chance to kind of choose who you're working with. But then those who don't have access to, you know, the only can use their insurance for therapy can only access certain kinds of therapeutic help. And so that's part of the reason for the show for me, is that I get concerned that we have, you know, there's an elite few that get the therapy of talk therapy, heart-centered therapy. But then everyone else kind of gets the medical model type of therapy that is very medication driven. And that's why we see those in the lower economic populations have the highest rate of medications.
Right, exactly. Well, and of course, medication with children is another topic. But I want to get back to this story thing.
Yes.
And look at this in the biggest sense of a cultural story.
Yes.
And this has to do with trauma. One of the grave dangers of telling people they're traumatized is they actually see themselves as a helpless victim. Mm-hmm. That isn't necessarily part of my definition of trauma, but it's part of the cultural definition of trauma, that you're the victim of circumstance. Well, first of all, none of us can afford to be the victim of circumstance, but there's too many circumstances. Did you ever hear this line from Camus? "All my life I have kept appointments I did not make." That's what it's about. We don't get to choose this nice, even life full of happy events. We might think we will. We might, when we're 18, never think we'll have Alzheimer's or have to contend with a mate with dementia. But these things can all happen to us. All of us, they can happen to. When I was doing therapy and a woman came in to say she'd been sexually assaulted, after I listened to what she wanted to say without interrupting her, my first question was always, when you look back on this incident, a lot of terrible things happened that weren't under your control, but what are you proud of? What happened in this incident that looking back on it, you realize I did the right thing there, or I made a good decision in the face of all this chaos and confusion? And from my point of view, the real issue isn't ever trauma, it's resilience. Mm. That's always the issue. So if cultural stories get framed in terms of trauma, they need the counterframing of resilience. They go hand in hand. Humans are resilient. We've been around for going back 3 million years because we're good problem solvers, we're good copers. We move on, we adjust to incredible circumstances. And I use the phrase transcendent response to talk about something people do all the time. We had a couple in this town. Their son was in college his first year. I think it was his first week of college. He drank so much alcohol, he died of alcohol poisoning. Well, this couple decided to devote the rest of their life and all of their monies to alcohol education for college students. That's a very typical response. If you go to a dialysis ward or a cancer ward, people aren't sitting around complaining about their symptoms. They're joking around and talking about how their grandmother made better chocolate cake than anybody they've ever met. We naturally are resilient people. And so anytime we get into this, the medical model, talk about a problem-saturated story in itself, and the victim story. I mean, people are victims. I mean, they're victims of domestic violence. Children are victims of poverty. The word victim is not a bad word, but it's overextended to imply a lot of other meanings, such as helplessness, lack of resilience, lack of competence to move out of that situation, etc. So I really like books like, it's called A Paradise Born in Hell, that looks at people who have gone through a great disaster and how they immediately form communities that help. Store owners, always known for their greed, open up their store and tell everyone to come in and take whatever. People that were never known for their courage suddenly lead a chain of children out of a school that's falling down. We all have within us these enormous capacities to grow, to be heroic, to learn. And so any kind of mental health model that doesn't focus on that is a grave disservice to the client.
So in some ways, it almost seems like our cultural story is one that's very traumaphobic, wants to pretend that we can live a life without suffering, right? In San Luis Obispo, you know, has been named the happiest city in America.
Oh, that's very interesting.
It's
a beautiful city.
It is beautiful, but I think that moniker, the happiest city in America, is somehow burdens the people who live there because happiness is such a fleeting emotion. What I think I hear you saying is that we have to almost bring the inevitability of suffering and trauma, almost embrace that piece of life into our cultural story to help balance our well-being.
That's right. On the other hand, the other side of that is how extraordinarily resilient people are in the face of pain and trauma. And of course, Bruno Bettelheim, we're about through. Of course, Bruno Bettelheim is a marvelous example of that. But I'm thinking as I write this book about older women, my next book is going to be called Women Rowing North. And it's about the developmental stage between middle age and the end of our journey. And one word I've thought about using to describe, or one phrase for women my age that are happy, that have good lives, that have managed to make the choices that lead them to a place where they can be happy, is we're all profiles in courage. We've all, over the course of a lifetime, weathered many a storm and done things that required a great deal of resilience and courage. Or we couldn't be here today, like you and me. You're younger than me, but like the two of us, you know, having a beautiful talk like this.
And this has been A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And it was really difficult to come to the end of this conversation with Dr. Mary Pfeiffer. This is a conversation that I had thought about and prepared for and drove 3,000 miles to have. But I leave Lincoln, Nebraska, feeling renewed. I feel energized. I feel excited to keep sharing these stories about how we can all take charge of our mental health and live a story that best supports a meaningful, satisfying, and healthy life. I am Elizabeth Barrett, and thank you for supporting Public Radio KCBX, this program, my crazy summer of shows from the road, and I look forward to sharing the next story from our next stop in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, next Tuesday at 2.
When it's not always raining, there'll be days like this. When there's no one complaining, there'll be days like this. Everything falls into place like the flick of a switch. Well, my mama told me there'll be days like this. When you don't need to worry, there'll be days like this. When no one's in a hurry, there'll be days like this. When you don't get betrayed by that old Judas kiss. Oh, my mama told me there'll be days like this. When you don't need an answer, there'll be days like this. When you don't need a chance, there'll be days like this. When all the parts of the puzzle start to look like they fit, then I must remember there'll be days like this.